Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Are you doing field stuff right now? Are you going out on boats?
I wish. I do. I mean, I used to go and do a lot of field work and do work on oceanographic vessels. And these days I sit with my computer and I analyze data and I write papers. Mm-hmm. But my mind gets to travel all over the place. And I'm thinking about these days the Sea of Japan, the Bering Sea, the glacial North Pacific. There's great beauty out there. And we, part of science is getting to explore that.
Hey, this is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm here with Rachel Myrie. She's an oceanographer and a climate scientist at the University of Washington.
Well, so I had garnered a degree of attention after I published my PhD. And so I had like currency and like a bit of a public eye because I was this elevated scientific voice. And that was fine and good, and I got to talk about climate change and oceanography and marine ecology, but then the Me Too movement happened last November, and that really broke pieces inside me where I had to come to terms. So I came to the table then and wrote pieces in Newsweek and in The Stranger about my experiences as a scientist with harassment and sexual assault and rape. So those things catalyzed a shift inside of me to begin to be brave enough to talk about these really, really hard pieces that are a component of my professional life as a scientist.
What was it like then making the decision to write about it so publicly and then actually doing it?
You know, at the time I had finished working with a really amazing student at the University of Washington, and I was shepherding her career, and I was in a place of thinking of how terrible it would be if something happened to her like it had happened to me. And so it brought it to a place where I could no longer be silent, because I really felt a responsibility to the safety and the stewardship of the careers of these young people. So that was the machinery inside of me that forced a shift to come forward.
So how would you describe the response?
I get harassed all the time on the internet. I get weird emails. I get hate mail. And the majority of that is in line with a lot of what other women scientists also receive. So this is just a phenomenon that the people that are in my position experience, but it's a ton of hate. The response has been amazing from other women in science. It's been remarkable. And I think my choice to speak out catalyzed particularly a huge shift in the community. Not to put myself in any like self-inflating position, but I think I played an important role in initiating the now sort of community-wide efforts to stop the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Health from funding known harassers, trying to divest these institutions, public institutions, from known harassers on their list of like fellows. So now we are pushing into the institutions around us to say, you're not a good scientist if you sexually harass and assault people. You don't get to participate in the community. So this is how we build a safer, more inclusive community, right? Is to say, it matters when people are victimized and we can do better.
Rachel Myrie, she's a research associate at the University of Washington, and these days, an activist. On today's show, it's stories of the squeaky wheel, people who chose to speak up even when it would have been so much easier not to. That's all in this week's Sound Effect from KNKX. Now a place where you're supposed to be a squeaky wheel, in the hospital. Experts say it's important to be your own advocate as a patient, and that goes double when you're the parent of a sick child. So what does that feel like from a doctor's point of view? Well, Sam Blackman is a cancer researcher and a former pediatric oncologist in Seattle. He shares this story of two assertive parents and the lessons they taught him.
I was a pediatric resident at a well-respected hospital in the Midwest. And to get in, I had taken a lot of tests. I had a lot of confidence. I mean, I walked in there with two doctoral degrees, right? My medical degree and a PhD in pharmacology. And to be a pediatric resident and to not have children is an interesting thing because you are a textbook expert on children as a population, but you have essentially no expertise in parenting or in that parent's child. During residency, it's typically 1 month long block rotations throughout all of the subspecialties of whatever it is that you're looking to practice. So for pediatrics, it was a month in neonatal intensive care unit and a month on pediatric surgery and a month on, you know, general pediatrics. And there was a mother of a patient on the cardiology service, and we were all terrified of this mother. Mrs. G, oh, Mrs. G. She was a night owl. So she would either be gone during the day working or she'd be asleep, and we'd round and we'd make the plan. But at night, she would be up and she would like read the chart. She'd read the progress notes that we would write about what was going on during the day. And if she saw something that she didn't like, she would have the nurse page the resident on call who'd have to come and talk to her. And if you're on call every third night or every fourth night, like your goal is to keep everything quiet so you can get some sleep. One night, I was asleep, and the nurse paged me because Mrs. G wanted to talk to the resident. You know, I get out of bed, my call room, and I drag myself down the hall onto the ward into her room, and she's up. And honestly, to this day, I can't remember specifically what the concern was. I just remember thinking to myself, now you're just torturing me. Like, there's nothing here that's going to change what I'm going to do right now. There's no acute emergency. And I told her, like, whatever it is that you're concerned about, I'm not seeing. We'll keep an eye on it. And if anything changes, I'm just down the hall sleeping. And I was so tired. I left the room. And at that point, I lost it. And I turned to the nurse who had paged me, and I yelled at her out loud. And I said, don't you dare call me again unless that kid is coding. And Mrs. G was 10 feet away and the doors open and she heard what I said. I look back over that episode now and I know what my mistakes were. And the biggest mistake that I made was not recognizing that not only was Mrs. G's child's heart diseased and broken, but Mrs. G's heart was broken. That she didn't know what was going to happen to her child. She didn't know if he was going to get better or not. And she was trapped in that hospital room, like her child was trapped in that hospital room. And what she needed was me to be a doctor for her as well. And what I wasn't seeing were the symptoms of her broken heart. And it changed the way that I took care of patients from that day forward. And I recognized that if I was feeling like that, it wasn't that the parent was doing something wrong. It's I was being tested. I think I was substantially better by the time I started my oncology fellowship and really dramatically changed the types of relationships that I had with parents of children with cancer going forward, because I would never, ever feel satisfied until I felt that I had heard everything that I needed to hear, because I knew that sometimes the words as they were being spoken weren't the message, it was what was underneath, and sometimes it just took time to find that. I was doing a rotation through the oncology service, and there was a little girl who had, without a doubt, one of the worst brain tumors ever that you can have, almost uniformly fatal. 95-98% of children die from that disease. This little girl, who I'll call Brianna, her mother was a single mom, and she just wanted no part of the care team. She would not even let us into the room because she just didn't see the point, because she knew that the diagnosis was devastating and that the outcome was going to be fatal. We'd stand outside of the door and we'd talk about the child in the abstract. But there were times when Brianna's mother would come out of the room when she wanted to try her own things. She was very much into alternative modes of therapy. She came to us one day because she wanted to give Brianna daily coffee enemas. Turns out that there's this alternative therapy called Gerson therapy. It's not ever been shown to be effective in any way, shape, or form, and it's really sort of a fringe thing in the medical literature, but it involved daily coffee enemas. And so I went back and I talked to Brianna's mother and I laid out what I had found. And by taking her seriously and actually engaging her as an adult and listening to her, she actually began to let me into the room. And then I would come out and I'd tell the team what I found. And for a while, I was exclusively the only person she would let, besides the nurses, the only person she'd let into the room. And I was basically her personal doctor. But, you know, rotations don't go on forever. And at the end of the month, I moved on to the next thing. You know, I think about that time, about how you walk out of the situation where you're a master at taking tests, you're great at filling in the bubbles, you've got a sheaf of number two pencils at the ready at all times. And then you're in the situation, being a doctor, taking care of patients, where you're tested and sometimes you don't even know what the questions are, let alone the answers, or you don't even recognize that you're being tested. I never got a chance to apologize to Mrs. G. Mrs. G was a great teacher. She taught me a lesson that I needed to learn. Brianna's mother was a great teacher for me because she taught me what happens if you actually pass that test. I was out to dinner one night with my wife, and I was coming home, and my pager went off, and it was from a part of the hospital where the palliative care patients go, patients at the end of their lives. And the nurse said, I know you're not on call, and I know you're not even on service, but it looks like Brianna is going to die tonight. Would you like to come in? And so I dropped my wife off at home, and I went back to the hospital. Dying is a process from a disease like a brain tumor, and it is not an easy process. You don't just stand there as a physician, you actually try to work to alleviate symptoms and pain. But it takes a long time because while the tumor in the brain is shutting down higher order functions in the brain, the heart and the lungs of an 8-year-old are like, well, wait a second, I'm like only 8 years old, and they are strong and they keep going. And it's heartbreaking to say, and it's heartbreaking to think about, and it's heartbreaking to watch. We just had to do what doctors for a long time have done, which is to just be present, to bear witness. And at some point in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, Brianna had stopped breathing. And so I went into the room, and Brianna's mother's in there, and then Brianna is lying in her bed, and I did what you're supposed to do. You feel for a pulse. You put your stethoscope on the chest and you listen for a full 60 seconds to ensure the absence of a heartbeat and respiration. And you make note of the time of death. And as I was leaving the room, I said to Brianna's mother, I said, I'm so sorry for your loss. Is there anything that I can do for you? And she said, can you pray with me? And so I'm like a secular Jew from New Jersey, and I was not the praying type. I didn't really believe in God at that point. And I also felt that it was weird, and I was really questioning, like, should I be pretending to pray over a newly dead child? Like, and I'm in my head, and I'm thinking about me. But then I realized that Brianna's mother needed me to do this, and she needed me to be the doctor that she had seen me as for the past number of months. And so I went back, and she and I held hands, and we stood at Brianna's bedside. And she closed her eyes, and so I closed my eyes. And then she started speaking, and she happened to say the one non-Jewish prayer that I actually knew. And she said, "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven."
Sam Blackman is a physician and researcher in Seattle, where he's also a regular at live storytelling events. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect from KNKX. In the small hours of April 2nd in 2001, a 92-foot trawler called the Arctic Rose was swallowed up by the Bering Sea. The Seattle-based crew of 15 went down with it, and it was called the deadliest fishing accident in 50 years. There was no Mayday call, no survivors, and no obvious reason for this terrible tragedy. A Coast Guard investigation came up with its most likely scenario, that the crew had mistakenly left a watertight door open, allowing waves to swamp the boat. But that never sat right with Bob Ford. Ford was an investigator with the National Transportation Safety Board, and he developed his own explanation for what likely happened, which he then sat on for 14 years. Finally, in 2015, a by-now-retired Bob Ford decided to become a squeaky wheel.
Because I just said, hey, this could be the last gasp, the last chance to get the truth out, or at least to get another assessment out, because the family members are sitting back thinking the reason why their family members, their loved ones died, was because they left a back door open. Even one of the media outlets got a bunch of all the surviving closest relatives in a room and, you know, taped them and interviewed them. And Mikey's sister said, you know, the sad part is they did this to himself by leaving that door open. And when I saw it, I just groaned and said, oh no, that's not why this happened.
Before we go on, we need to do a quick review of some maritime vocabulary. Port.
Left.
Starboard.
Right.
Stern.
Back.
Keel.
The spine of a ship's bottom.
And trawl.
To drag a fishing net through deep water.
Got it? Okay, so back to Bob Ford and why he decided to go public with his minority report.
The Coast Guard truly believed that they must have been sleeping on the Arctic Rose. And I wasn't ready or willing to just blindly accept that and say, well, okay. So that was one of the first bones of contention, if you want to put it that way, just something I disagreed with. I just wasn't going to go down that path without, I wanted a lot more proof of that.
Could you kind of summarize the Coast Guard's interpretation of events and what they concluded about the most likely cause of the sinking?
The Coast Guard basically felt that a front came through. The winds kicked up to easily exceeding 45 knots. The seas are going to kick up. They feel, because of the position of the rudder, that a sea came over. They looked at the ROV video and said the door was open on the stern.
ROV is a remote operated vehicle, so like an underwater camera?
Correct. They felt they picked out the door, and I thought they were dreaming. I did not believe it was the door. And I look at this, and I'm going, wait a second. You're telling me that's the door? If you're saying that's the door, you're saying it's hinged to port. Well, the door on the Arctic Rose was hinged to starboard. And so what they pointed out of their smoking gun just didn't smoke to me. Now, you have to realize at this point, I had been taken off the investigation. Before they even sent the ROV down, the director of the office said, we have too many other issues, too many other investigations, we're too small an office, and I'm going to have to pull you off. We'll wait till see what the Coast Guard comes up with. So at this point, I'm working under the table, so to speak, or behind the scenes, or whatever term you want to use.
And why is that, why is that, Bob? Why not just say, okay, time to move on?
I mean, something I've asked myself that question, and I've gotten so involved at the investigation at this point, I was not comfortable. Some of the things I felt the Coast Guard were saying and possibly the direction they were heading, I've asked myself that question a number of times. Why didn't I just let it go? I don't know. Same thing when they found the part of the remains of Jeff Meinke.
Well, after the fact, as you alluded to, they did recover a portion of, you know, the remains of one of the crew members. What happened there, and how did that land with you?
Well, what had happened was, I believe this was in 2015, early 2015 or late 2014. I go on the Seattle Times and front page this story about the recovery of remains of the youngest on the boat, and a picture of Jeff Meinke and his mother. Then I started reading it, and it was like, oh, I couldn't believe it. It was almost like, this can't be true. This can't be accurate. This is like a one in a billion chance, with as big as the Pacific Ocean is, and one trawler scoops up a bunch of fish, and remains of Jeff Meinke comes up. It's almost like I felt, you know what? It sounds like the dead on the Arctic Rose are not resting in peace, and somehow he found his way to speak out.
How did you begin developing your own picture of what you think happened?
I had to do this on the sly, by this point I had a new immediate supervisor. And he saw a box come in from the Coast Guard of additional information. And he says, what is this? And I go, it's the Arctic Rose. And at first I was going to say, well, I'm trying to stop the Coast Guard from sending it. But I said, no, I'm not lying to the guy. I said, I'm still working on it on my own time. And he goes, just don't let the director find out. Well, things turned sour in that office pretty quickly. And I, January, February of 2006, I said, March 1st, I'm done at the NTSB. That's 5 years, and I'm out. And so there was internal politics over the whole issue. So I just kept basically working on it on my own time. I don't know how many times I looked at that ROV video of the so-called stern door and of this so-called no hold, what they say. And I just would drive home, and sometimes I'm thinking, what am I missing? What am I missing? And that's where the whole issue of the oil slick came from. Boats, ships that sink quickly and just flip over and go down, based on their scenario, which is what happened to the Arctic Rose, don't leave 5 mile oil slicks.
So what was your scenario?
I think the trawl doors, which would have been pulled in to the outboard side of the boat, broke loose, came around and hit the fuel tank, the day tank, which provides fuel to the engine. So you got water in the fuel, engine dies, you have the battery room flooded, and now you have no VHF radios to make a call. So now you have also oil leaking, front flooding, no propulsion. And they just went down. And I would almost bet they went down bow first and did almost a somersault and landed on their keel.
Do you think you would have done anything differently if you had it to do over again?
At the NTSB?
Yeah.
I've asked myself that too. And I have to say, I don't think so. I mean, I didn't go into the NTSB with an attitude, I'm going to be the Sherlock Holmes of the NTSB and Marine Investigations. I would have to basically say, for me to have remained at the NTSB, I would have had to have basically swallowed certain beliefs, and I just, there's no way I was going to do that.
Bob Ford is a retired investigator with the National Transportation Safety Board. He lives in Virginia. The Coast Guard has said it stands by its investigation. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme this week is Squeaky Wheel. The plan for Nathan Myhrvold was to go into academia. He had his PhD in physics and had even done some work with Stephen Hawking. But then he got pulled into this side project. The project turned into a company. The company got acquired by a little Redmond concern called Microsoft. And before long, Nathan became Microsoft's first chief technology officer. But Myhrvold kept his passion for science. And while he was at Microsoft, in his abundant free time, he started writing papers about dinosaurs.
Everybody loves dinosaurs when they're a kid. And professional paleontologists are just people who never lost that. So don't ask me why I'm interested. It's like, what happened to you?
I met Myhrvold at the Bellevue headquarters of his current company, Intellectual Ventures. His office is littered with dinosaur fossils and space rocks. He wears jeans and a t-shirt that says, "Pizza is beautiful." He may not be a professional scientist, but he's got a track record of confronting the pros when he finds flaws in their work. And that led me to my impolite first question: why be such a pain in the butt to mainstream science?
I would say I'm not a pain in the butt to mainstream science. You know, in the case of dinosaurs, I've published many papers on dinosaurs, and I was well enough established that at the annual conference where all the dinosaur paleontologists go, I knew pretty much everybody, not totally, but pretty much. Now, I did discover that there was a series of papers on dinosaur growth rates where the people who had done the studies had cooked the books. They cheated. Okay, they made data up. They did a variety of other things. It was clear case of scientific misconduct. And that led to a big battle, but I don't think mainstream dinosaur science thought I was a pain in the butt. I mean, this one guy thought I was a pain in the butt. And in fact, there were lots of other paleontologists that suspected this guy either was wrong or had really screwed things up, but they were reticent to bring it up. And that's because this guy had attained a certain amount of stature. You know, it's very easy for scientists to say, hey, I support, you know, the highest quality research. And, you know, of course, we don't want to have any things that are bad. And it's easy to enforce that if what you're doing is failing some student who cheated on an exam. Well, when you have someone who has attained a high degree of stature in the field, it's very difficult to come back and say, wait a minute, this person cheated. In this dinosaur case, another paleontologist came up to me after it was all published and he said, you know, I knew that there was something wrong with it, but if I asked a graduate student to work on that, it'd be like asking him to walk into a buzzsaw.
So what is it about you, do you think, that made you not leave it alone?
Well, I asked this guy, and he said, I don't have tenure yet. This guy would block my tenure. There's no way I could do it. Whereas me, I have tenure at Nathan University. You know, I don't need to go through a laborious process where people in my department write letters to all sorts of folks in the field and ask if I'm worthy. I don't have an academic job.
How is it similar to and how does it differ from what came up later with the NASA data?
In that case, some people who wanted to build a space telescope to find asteroids that could hit Earth came to see me hoping I would give them some money or I would endorse their project to various rich friends of mine. And I got interested in what they said, and I started doing some calculations. Well, as part of that, I discovered one of those projects, a proposed project, had made a colossal error in their physics. They had forgotten something called Kirchhoff's law. Now, this is a first-year college physics kind of a thing. In fact, good high school physics covers it. But they had screwed it up. I contacted them, and this project had talked to me almost every day. Well, as soon as I asked about this and about their previous project, which was a NASA project that was largely completed, which had tried to estimate the size of 150,000 or so asteroids, well, I discovered they made that mistake there too. So these people were estimating the size of asteroids. Now, the way you check to see if that's correct is there's a small set of asteroids where we know the diameter some other way. So what you're supposed to do is take the asteroids that we know the diameter of a different way and now compare your estimates. Instead, they had copied the diameters of those ones we knew exactly. There really can't be any doubt about it. I suggested in one blog post that be a good project for a middle school science project. You take a list of diameters, you take these other lists, and like, oh, look, these numbers match exactly. Huh. Well, they stopped talking to me, and I kept calculating and kept doing things, and I kept assuming that they would come around and say, oh, well, okay, we screwed up. Or they'd say, oh, Nathan, you screwed up. Here's where you screwed up. Didn't get either one. And the similarity is, this is a group which is very famous in the field. The NASA program office that they're associated with is the main funding source for asteroids. And I think the similarity is, just as the dinosaur guy was a total jerk about using peer review and other things to threaten people, this group did the same thing. When my first paper on this came out, I got several emails from people. One said, you know, welcome to the club of people who this group is, NEOWISE group, has tried to squelch.
Is this something that's like part of your personality or your intellectual kind of constitution that you persist doggedly when you've got a bone like this?
Well, mostly, you know, in asteroids, I'm doing lots of other work because I've gotten into it now. And that work isn't about correcting other people's mistakes. It's about just taking brand new ideas. And in dinosaurs, I had published many papers on dinosaurs prior to those growth rate studies, and I've published a bunch since that weren't about that. They were about other things. So I don't know what combination of things caused these to come my way. But it is true that once they did come my way, and once I saw the bad behavior, I wasn't going to let it go. And the more that they tried intimidation, the more I knew I had to be correct, because they'd use a real argument if they didn't have to try intimidation. And part of transparency is you have to be able to investigate stuff. And if it's unspeakable to say that a scientist cheated, guess what? You're going to have more cheaters than if it's speakable. Science is supposed to be idealistic. And if it isn't idealistic, it's nothing. And that idealism includes when you find a clear case of cheating, you have to call it out. So I certainly don't look for examples in science where this occurs. But I'm also not going to look the other way.
Nathan Mervold is the CEO of Intellectual Ventures, based in Bellevue, and also an amateur physicist and paleontologist, photographer, and cookbook author. And just a quick epilogue. Mervold told me this little story about something that happened to him, and I just wanted to share it.
One of the funniest aspects of this whole thing is I happened to turn on TV. I was in a hotel room. Well, it turns out there's a TV show called Elementary, which is a Sherlock Holmes set in modern New York. I can't believe it. The premise of that episode was a guy outside the field of astronomy decided that asteroid measurements were done wrong and got murdered. So we'll see how much impact I have on mainstream science, but man, I have already gotten a TV show. I've inspired a TV show, you know, one of these ripped from the headlines, tweak just a couple things. Well, hey.
A week ago, Cole submitted a paper to a science blog saying that he believed the whole way we're looking for asteroids is wrong.
Miscalculating near-Earth asteroids and the threat to human existence.
He wrote that scientists have detected thousands of new asteroids in the last few years. But according to him, our measurements of their sizes are useless.
When it comes to protecting the human race from an extinction-level impact, obviously size matters. It's not just enough to know that an asteroid is there. We need to know which ones are the big ones.
Sound Effect is produced by Jennifer Wing and Kevin Kniestad with Bethany Denton. We had help this week from Janae Janik, Monica Spain, Max Hendricks, and Paul Currington. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. I hope you'll take a second to subscribe to our now twice weekly podcast. Find us on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you access that sort of thing. And that includes your smart speaker. Just say, "Play Sound Effect, the podcast." And we love to hear your feedback. I can guarantee you a personal response. You can find us on Facebook or email soundeffect@knkx.org. We're back next week with Tales of the Folly of Youth. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.